Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring Team Poker Stars pro Dennis Phillips with Paul Harris.
You got to
now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan KFNS.
Jackpot. Thank you, sir. May I have another?
Welcome to the show. It's another one of our famous two-country final table shows today. I am Paul Harris, sitting here in St. Louis, the home of Harrah's St. Louis World Series of Poker Room, while my partner Dennis Phillips is off on another international adventure. Where are you today, Dennis?
I am in Nassau, Bahamas, at a resort called the Atlantis, which is, if you've never been down here, it's a little bit unbelievable. Let me give you a little bit of an idea of where I'm at. It's on Paradise Island, which is just a waterway away from Nassau, but it's a private island, and they pretty much turned this into the whole island into a resort. The Atlantis has literally thousands of rooms. They've got about five different towers down here, and it's phenomenal. It is an island, so you've got, you know, I'll give you an idea. I'm sitting on a balcony in the Cove, one of the towers, one of the better towers, actually, and I'm looking out over the ocean, and as far as the eye can see, and I've got this beautiful white beach in front of me. I've got pools. I've got, it's just phenomenal. They've got a place called The Reef, which is condos that you can also rent from some of the owners. They've got the Cove here, which is on the north side of this particular island. And it's just, you know, it breathtaking views here.
Now, for people who've been listening to this show since we started it nearly 3 years ago, they may remember the first time you went down there, after which I teased you mercilessly because all of this beautiful stuff you're describing, you never saw or touched any of it. The first year, which I think it was January of 2010, was that the first PCA?
Oh, 09.
Wow. 09. Okay, yeah. So the first year you went down there and you did not touch a grain of sand or a drop of water. But now I know your girlfriend is with you this year, and I'm sure she's making you get some sun.
Well, got down here on Friday, and we went around and checked everything out, and then I didn't play till Sunday. So Saturday, I went up and down the slides. I went on the rafting on the river. I ended up turning deep red before the date was out.
Well, your skin is not used to being exposed to the sun.
Yeah, no kidding. There's so many buildings here. You can actually go from the towers all the way to the conference center where the poker is being played without ever going outside.
Yeah.
You know, some gorgeous, nice, picturesque windows. You can look at it, but you never have to physically go outside if you don't want to. However, why wouldn't you? I missed so much the first couple of years I was down here by not going out and partaking of it. But definitely we went out there. We up and down the slides, around the lazy river, they call it. It's just nice. The rafting, it's a mile-long rafting thing you can do. There's tennis courts, there's basketball courts, there's spas, there's you name it, it's here. Atlantis is a great place to come.
Now, of course, you're also down there to play a little bit of poker, because the reason you're there is for the Poker Stars Caribbean Adventure, the PCA, which is one of the largest events going on anywhere in the world. You know, the WSOP is huge, and the WSOP Europe and the EPT are huge, and now they've got some big tournaments going on in Asia and Macau and those places, and the LAPT in Latin America is big. But this one is really something special because of the location and because of the size of the fields. I'm curious, though, since this is the first PCA post-Black Friday, what are the crowds like and what are the fields like?
Well, it is a little bit different than last year. Last year, our main event, we had almost 1,700 that paid the $10,000. It was the second largest in the world. This year, we did see a drop, but it was just under 1,100. There was still a substantial amount of people here. And when you walk the halls, you see all of the normal faces. A very, very good turnout. The high roller last year had 38 people that paid $100,000. This year, it was 32 people. So, again, a bit of a drop. I think it's a drop because of the U.S. players not being able to qualify online. That was the biggest thing. Last year, I think they had like 1,100 that qualified online to play in the main event. This year, it's more like 600.
But still,
but there's still massive crowds.
Yeah,
massive people down here.
Still, half the field or more is qualified online, so you probably have a lot of first timers there, which is always good anytime you're in a tournament. I know you played in the main, which started off over the weekend with a day 1A and a 1B, and you made it to day two. Unfortunately, today is day three, and you're not in it anymore, right?
That is correct. I took about three bad beats. The first one about the third level of day one, it wasn't bad play. It just bad results. So I can't really fault the guy that I was playing against. However, when you lose to a two-outer, it's never fun. So I guess I can describe the hand very quickly. I raised out of position with a 9-8 offsuit. However, we started with 30,000. I had a little over 40,000. I was having a fun time at the table, shall we say. I could pretty much raise with any hand I wanted to. The button called me. The flop comes a 9-8-6.
Beautiful.
So with two diamonds. So it's a wet board. There's lots of, it's very draw heavy, but I've got top two. I've got to feel comfortable with this. Instead of, because it is, you know, a draw heavy board, I went ahead and let out. The guy on the button repopped it substantially. I looked at him, thought for a minute. He's got to be putting me on an overpair of some sort or else just a continuation bet. And I shoved. And he insta-called.
Oh, no, which, don't tell me he had 10-7. He can't have 10-7 there.
Yeah, well, he didn't. That was my first thought when he insta-called like that. I went, oh, man, have I stepped into it. I just really, really screwed up, and they turned over the 9-6, and I said, never mind.
Oh, wow. So you flop top two. He flops top and bottom. And
yep.
Since you said you got caught by a two-outer, there must have been a six on either the turn or the river.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. But, I mean, the guy looked at me and says, I thought you had, like, jacks. And I said, that's what you were supposed to think. You know, I mean, it played out exactly the way you wanted right until the river when the six turned over.
Oh.
So, and that was a $50,000+ pot.
Oh.
So it put me down to about 13,000. I got down to 6,200 was my low point. The ninth level of day one, I kind of shifted gears. I ended up shoving in nine times. Seven times I wasn't called. The two times I was called, I won both of those. I ended up with 36,000 bagging at the end of day one.
But still, that's well below average, which I'm guessing was in the 55 to 60 range?
Exactly. I think it was about 59.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's it exactly. Came back. And this hand, I think I misplayed, to be honest about it. You set all night, you come back down there. Basically, the first hand I sit down with, I wake up to pocket jacks under the gun. So the blinds at this time were 4 and 8. I made it 2,000, and the guy next to me pops it up to 5,100.
Mm.
I thought and thought, okay, I can see a flop for 3,000, or I can shove. I just called to see the flop. It came king, rag. I made a bet out there of 4,000, hoping he didn't have a king or something, and the guy came over the top big.
Mm.
So I threw it away, and he actually showed me king, queen.
Oh.
However, I really think that when he bet the 5,100 pre-flop, if I'd have shoved, he would have folded, and I think that should have been my move. I was short enough stack. I think I misplayed the hand. I should have just shoved. I think he would have gone away. But
how much more would it have been? When he made it 5,100, if you shove, how much more is it?
I had 3,600 or 36,000 to start
with. Oh, 36,000. Okay.
Yeah. So, I mean, if I shove there, I really think he goes away. He did have more than that. He had right at chip average. He had around 60,000. But that was going to cost him a little better than half of his chip stack.
Yeah.
I don't think on the first hand of the day that he would have called me there. I think he would have gone into the tank, thought about it a while, and then folded.
Wow.
But I also didn't want to go down there and play one hand and walk away after fighting that hard on the ninth level of day one.
Right.
So, you know, I think I misplayed the hand. I think I should have shoved there. But, you know, that's hindsight.
Yep. Absolutely. So,
anyhow.
I was just going to ask, so you ended up going out. Anything special about the hand you got knocked out on?
Actually, yeah, I think I played it right. And I think the other guy had some fold equity that he didn't exhibit. I started out the hand with about 22,000 in the big blind. The blinds at this time were 8 and 16. So with a $200 ante. And we were playing eight-handed at this time. So there's 7,200 in the pot pre-flop before a card is dealt. A guy mid-raised. He made it 3,200, so only raised to 1,600. Folds all the way around to me in the big blind. I have a queen-eight suited, queen-eight of spades. So I called the 1,600. The flop came 9-9-8. I open shoved for the remaining 20,000 that I had in front of me.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who had mid-raised had about 40,000, just a little under it. So it was going to, again, cost him over half his chips to do this. He shrugged his shoulders and said, okay, I call. And I went, oh, I'm in big trouble. He turned over an ace-jack offsuit.
What?
Yeah, I looked at it and I, okay, I'll roll the dice with that. No problem. It flopped two diamonds. It came diamond-diamond on the turn and river, and he had a diamond.
Or flushed me. Now, you know, I see people doing this in tournaments all the time, and, you know, of course, when they lose, it's not a story. But when they win, you know, it's a story, and you think to yourself, okay, what was he thinking? And I can usually not figure out what the thinking is there. So walk this through, if you would. Why would he be calling you there with ace-jack? Yes, you had just called him out of position in one of the blinds, and the flop came 9-9-8. That's not a horrible board for his hand, but when you bet out, he's got to figure that you've got something. So why the call? Can you explain it?
The only thing I can do, I was playing fairly aggressive. If I got involved in the hand, my chips were probably going in because I was short enough stacked, and people knew that. I think he put me on basically a move where it was it's a call shove, where you just call it, and then you're going to shove on any three cards that come out there. And he thought I was bluffing. Absolutely thought I had nothing. Mm. That's the only thing I can guess. I didn't. I had the eight.
Right.
But,
so he figures that his ace-jack has got to be good because you didn't three-bet him pre-flop, so you probably don't have anything better than that.
Correct. That's what he had to be thinking. But honestly, if I'd had a small pair and it comes out a nondescript flop like that, or if I had a big draw, or if I had a nine, I probably would still open shove because nobody would put me on the nine.
Yeah. Yeah.
My range of hands was monstrous.
I can see you in that situation playing it exactly the same way with a nine, with an eight, and with sixes, fives, fours, threes, or deuces.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's a ton of hands. I could have played ace-king the same way. I doubt it. I probably would have shoved pre-flop with ace-king, but, you know.
No, if you had a big hand there, you probably would have gotten it in, and you probably would have gotten it in with sixes or fives, come to think of it. So, but there's no reason why you can't have a nine or an eight in that situation. And by the way, I want to make clear, I'm not criticizing the guy's play. I'm trying to understand it.
Yeah, and you know, he did. It wasn't like it was an insta call or anything like that. He had this, you know, grimace on his face, and I call, and you know, I would have had a hard time calling because it would have crippled me. I would have gone from a 40,000 stack down to a 20,000 stack by losing that,
yeah.
And all of a sudden I'm the one who has no moves and has to shove and has no play available. So I doubt if I would have made that call. But then I probably would have done more than a mid-raise with an ace-jack, too.
Yeah. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Dennis Phillips is at the PCA in the Bahamas. I'm Paul Harris here in St. Louis. Our show, of course, brought to you by Harrah's St. Louis, home of the World Series of Poker poker room. Speaking of the WSOP, you're going to be able to go and play in a qualifier for the main event. They're starting up the 2012 main event qualifiers, not this weekend, but the following weekend, Saturday, January 21st, and Sunday, January 22nd. It'll be the double shootout format. This is the same format that got Dennis to the main event in 2008, where, of course, you know, he ended up being one of the members of that year's and the first ever November 9. It's a $200 buy-in. You'll have five tables at noon, five tables at 3 o'clock. The 10 winners of those tables then compete that evening at 6 o'clock at the final table, and the winner of that gets a $10,000 main event at the World Series of Poker seat. And I think you get a little spending money, too, to take care of your room or your airfare or whatever. But this is one of the best deals to get you into the main event that you'll find in the U.S. now, especially since online poker is gone. $200 buy-in. You only have to beat 18 people in the double shootout format, and you end up at the main event of the World Series of Poker. As we get closer to these, which are going to be running every month between now and the springtime, we're going to talk a little bit more about the format and exactly what your strategy should be when you play in these. But mark down those dates for the first ones of the year. I expect them to sell out January 21st and 22nd at Harrah's St. Louis. If you want more information, you can always contact their poker room at 314-770-7600 or go to harrahsstlewis.com. And while I'm plugging the place, let me also mention that the following weekend, January 27th, 28th, and 29th will be the weekend of Big Game 2. This is the $15,000 buy-in, 25-50 no-limit game. We played for the first time at the end of October, and we had nearly two full tables all through Friday night and all through Saturday night. Saturday, actually, we started at noon and went into late into Saturday night. We will be starting at 6 o'clock on Friday the 27th. If you are interested in being in that game, you can lock up a seat now, or you can get all the information by simply dropping an email to us at dennisphillipspoker@gmail.com. That's the email address that we have for the show that we both check, dennisphillipspoker@gmail.com. I will send you all the information you need and tell you how you can lock up a seat and get yourself a discounted hotel room for the weekend and all the rest of the details. There will also be, as there was last time, a 10-20 game going on. Probably going to have a couple of tables of that as well. The buy-in for that is $2,500 minimum, no max. And we should have a lot of fun. We have a lot more interest from people who didn't play the first time because it happened to coincide with a little thing called the World Series, which, as you may remember, was kind of a big deal here in St. Louis. We had some,
it was kind of a good result.
Yeah, absolutely. We had some people who had planned to play in our game who thought, well, I'm going to go to that game instead. Now they're going to be around and they're going to play, and so we should have a great time, and we would love to have you come in from out of town and play, or if you're a St. Louis poker player and you want to come in, let us know. DennisPhillipsPoker@gmail.com. Here are the dates again. January 21st and 22nd for the WSOP qualifiers, and then January 27, 28, 29 for Big Game 2 at Harrah's St. Louis, online at harrahsstlewis.com. All right, let's talk more about the PCA. Isildur One, a kid who came out of Sweden and no one knew who he was a couple of years ago, but all of a sudden he was playing these nosebleed stakes online matches, heads up against some of the best players in the world and crushing them. And then getting crushed and crushing them again and getting crushed. Some of the biggest swings the poker world has ever seen online. He had quite a weekend there in the super high roller, the 100K buy-in at the PCA, didn't he?
Absolutely did. Like I said, there were 32 people to start out with. There were actually two people that re-bought into this, Jonathan Duhamel being one of them. And I kind of wonder about the equity of sinking another $100,000 into an event you just got knocked out of.
Yeah.
But Jonathan actually, they only paid the top five, so it was very difficult to get down to it. Eric Seidel, who had been running so hot in all of the high rollers last year, did not make it. At one time, he was third in chips, but he did not make the final table. But Isidore ended up winning it. Jonathan ended up cashing. Daniel Negreanu ended up cashing. It was a good final table.
Yeah, the final five were Negreanu in fifth place, Duhamel in fourth place, Galen Hall third, Dan Shack in second, and then Victor Blom, Isildur 1, took it down. First place paid $1.25 million. And just a quick note here about Jonathan Duhamel. You know, he invested two buy-ins, which is $200K. His payout was $313K. So I guess that qualifies as a min cash, doesn't it?
That's a hell of a min cash, I have to admit, but I guess it does qualify for one.
But the really good news about this was, and you probably ran into him, you know, considering that he got beat up pretty severely in that home invasion in which he lost his main event bracelet from a couple of years ago to these thieves, who, by the way, have been caught and have been indicted, and they had hearings about it last week. But the good news is that he was healthy enough to be able to go down there and play. Did you see him, and how did he look?
Yeah, no, I saw him. He looks normal, healthy, everything there. Home invasion, I think they got like $115,000 in cash. They got his Rolex watch that PokerStars had given him. But the thing that probably hurt the most is they did get his main event bracelet. And the last I heard, they had not recovered that yet.
Yeah.
So hopefully they'll find that somewhere. I would think that anybody in the poker world, you'd have a hard time hawking it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. I'm not sure what kind of value that has on the black market there. One of the people involved is supposedly an ex-girlfriend of his, and I'm not going to go into all the details about it because if you want to, you can read it online. But I'm really happy to hear that he's doing okay and well enough to play.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He turned around. He got knocked out of the main event. He was playing the 5K yesterday. I'm not for sure if he made it to day two or not. I'll probably talk to him again. I'll talk to him. We'll see if we can get him on the show in the next couple of 3 weeks just to get caught up and see how his year went and what his plans are for the future. I believe he's going to be playing in the one drop event in Caesars this summer. He's planning on it, at least.
That's the $1 million buy-in event for Guy La Liberté's one drop charity that is going to be a bracelet event. And they say that they've got 22 so far who will cough up $1 million buy-in. By the way, you know, they say that they're capping the thing at, I don't know, what's the number, 40, 45, 48, something like that?
48, I believe, what they're capping it at.
Do you think if they actually had 48 people who signed up for this thing and were willing to cough up the million, that if a 49th millionaire were to come forward and say, I want to play, they go, I'm sorry, we're sold out?
Well, I'm not for sure they'll ever have to worry about that.
I don't think
either. I don't think so, but the way it stands right now and the structure and the way and how it's set up, 48 is the maximum.
Yeah.
Now then, would they open it up for another table? Well, possibly. But I don't know that they would for one person because it would kind of be – it would be very awkward.
Well, but they're not playing it as a shootout, are they? I mean, they're not doing it as like six tables of eight or maybe even eight tables of six. It's going to be a regular no-limit hold'em tournament, right?
It is. It is absolutely going to be that. So we'll see what happens. But again, the word that is coming out from the WSOP is that it's going to be capped at 48, that you need to sign up to make sure you guarantee your spot. I don't think there's any huge rush to get into it. Yeah, I think you've got time to consider it.
Oh, yeah, I've got time to consider it? Yeah, I've considered it, and the answer is no. That's how most people will react. Speaking of that million-dollar tournament, Daniel Negreanu blogged about his plans for this year a few days ago, and he says that he is going to play in the $1 million one-drop tournament, but he's going to sell off about 600,000 of that $1 million buy-in to backers, and he's going to let people who like him buy in for as little as $120 a piece. Now, I like Daniel, and he's got a pretty good record in some of these high-roller events. I think he's final tabled like three or four of them. If you were going to put if you're going to pick a horse and bet on him, that might not be a bad choice there to invest in a little bit of Daniel Negreanu. What do you say?
I agree with you that three of the last four high rollers that he's played in, he has cashed. He and Eric are the two that last year did the best by far in the high roller events. So if you're going to pick a horse, probably one of those two would be the ones. And there is some equity here. They're assuming that about half of the players are going to be businessmen, non-professionals, people that you would think the pros would have an edge on. So if you have, say, 40 people in it, 20 of them businessmen, 20 of them pros, There should be an edge to the professional. Now, the problem you have is that they're only going to pay the final table. They're only going to pay, I think, the top eight. So you've got to go through the field to make it down to that final eight. The cash is great if you actually make that. But, you know, it's going to be difficult to do.
Yep. $17 million for first place in that, by the way. We'll talk to Jonathan Duhamel when we get him on the show, which hopefully will be in the next couple of weeks. And then one last thing I want to ask you about, or one of the last things I want to ask you about, is also PCA related. And that has to do with a guy by the name of Randy Liu, who's known online as Nana Noko. And, you know, it's difficult to talk about online stuff now because most of our audience is American players, both here in St. Louis and people who listen to the podcast. And, you know, maybe it leaves a little bit of a bitter taste. And by the way, later on in the show, we're going to talk to Chris Krafcik, who's our expert on what's happening with legislation and court stuff around the country regarding online poker. But Nana Noko, Randy Liu, on Sunday went out to set a new Guinness Book of World Records record for, I guess it's for fastest online play or most hands played. And PokerStars, which actually has a limit on the number of tables you can play simultaneously, I think it's 24 or 25, they lifted the limit and let him play on 40 tables simultaneously. The deal was he would go for 8 hours and see how many hands he could play in that 8 hours, and he would set the record if and only if at the end of the 8 hours he made a profit. It had to be a profitable session. So he sat down there at the PCA somewhere, maybe you know, on Sunday, played for 8 hours, played 23,493 hands. That's just under 3,000 hands an hour, just under 49 hands per minute. And after 8 hours, ended up with a profit of $7.65. A profit of less than a dollar an hour. Now, at one point, he was down like $1,200, but he ended up plus $7.65. So now he's in the Guinness Book for the world record for fastest poker player or most hands played. And he kind of had this reputation before. But here's my question for you, Dennis. Is that poker?
But it actually isn't. Several on this. The record they set, and the Guinness people were here to watch him, to monitor it, to make sure that it was all legit, was how many hands can you play in an eight-hour period? So he played solid for 8 hours. He did get – his goal was 24,000. He didn't quite make it, but he came very close. And the condition of it is to require you – so you're actually playing poker – is you have to show a profit. Well, the problem is when you're playing a hand every second, which is basically what he was doing, you don't have time to make decisions. You're either folding or shoving. And that's pretty much what he did the whole time, was what I was told. I did not watch it. He was in the room over in one corner doing it. There was a number of people that were railing him and seeing how. But it flashes up on your screen, and you just instantly fold, 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 shove, fold, 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 shove, that type of a deal. And very, very few decisions. Anytime he'd have a decision, it would probably take him 3 or 4 seconds to do it. It would slow him down, and he'd make that decision, then he would move on. They were allowing him to have up to 48 games at any given time. I don't think he ever quite got that high. He was playing fairly low limits, to where it was no, if somebody busted him, it wasn't going to hurt him tremendously. But he did show a profit. He did get the $7 and some in profit. What he did get, what a lot of people don't realize, is a huge number of FPP points, frequent player points. So PokerStars rewards to their players for frequent playing.
Yeah.
You know, the number of hands you played and everything like that. Those are worth a heck of a lot more than the $7 he made.
Right.
In fact, at the beginning of the tournament, on day 1B, they brought up Monario, a PokerStars pro from Italy, and Elke, a PokerStars pro from France, and rewarded them with an extremely nice watch for accumulating 5 million FPP points.
Mm.
Yeah, 5 million. That's an exclusive club. That's not a club that I will ever be in, because it means you are literally playing day in, day out, 10 hours a day, multi-hands, on front of your computer. And that's not a club I'm ever going to join, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
That's massive amounts.
I agree with you about this not being poker, what Randy Liu did. I mean, it's impressive, but first of all, the thing that impresses me the most is that he was able to actually click whatever it was that he needed to do, fold or shove. He was able to do that in 1 second and do it every second for 8 straight hours, you know, without getting any wrist fatigue or anything, because those, I assume that he had more than one monitor in front of them, so he probably had to move the mouse around. It wasn't like they were all just popping up, boop, 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 right in front of him, because there's so many tables, he would have virtually no time to do anything. But just moving the mouse and clicking somewhere, try that randomly on your own, by the way. Try to do that and make a decision and then move the mouse to where you need to and click it every second for a minute, for 5 minutes, for 15 minutes, for an hour, for 8 hours. That's the remarkable achievement of this.
You know how they do caricatures of people. I just suddenly had this. How can you tell an online poker player? And they show this hand, and the hand looks normal except for the one finger. That's about three times the size of the others with muscles bulging on it. Click, 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 click.
Yeah, that's about it. All right, we're going to take a break here in a moment. Oh, you know what I want to mention here before we do take the break? And that is kind of a goodbye, if you will, to one of the great people of the world of poker. He's not a poker player. He's not a pro. But he has been responsible for an enormous number of tournaments over the last 18 years. His name is Jimmy Sommerfeld. We actually had Jimmy on the show 2 Aprils ago when Harrah's St. Louis hosted his first ever World Series of Poker circuit event. Jimmy and his crew from his company Poker Tournament Consultants, they came in and they ran that as they do probably more than half of the circuit events around the country. Not all of them, but more than half of them. And Jimmy's just one of the nice guys. If you don't like Jimmy Sommerfeld, I think there's something wrong with you. He announced last week online that he is retiring. After 18 years of doing this, he said, the decision was based solely on the fact that I want to spend more time with my wife, my 3 daughters, and my first grandchild that was born last week. And then he went on to thank Kenny Lambert, who you and I both know. He was the first poker room manager who gave Jimmy a shot. He was the tournament director of the Horseshoe down in Tunica. And he thanks Jack McClelland, who's one of the great poker tournament directors of all time, and Jack Effel, who is the tournament director of the World Series of Poker. And Jimmy worked on that during the summer as well as the poker manager. That was his title there. He also thanked all the staff and all the dealers because his company, PTC, would go out and hire dealers from all over the country and make sure they all got there and make sure everybody knew the rules. And when you were dealing with Jimmy and his crew, his floor people and his supervisors, I think, were uniformly the best in the business. They knew what they were doing and they could handle it and keep the games moving. And I never saw him making a bad decision. Jimmy came over a few times in a couple of tournaments of his that I played in, and he had to make floor calls, and he was able to clear things up and explain them so that everybody at the table, even an aggrieved party, would be satisfied with what he did. He's been one of the best, and I'm making it sound like an obituary. It's not. We wish him the absolute best in his life of retirement and happiness with his new grandchild and all the best. And the company is still going to go on. Bill Bruce, who's been the number two at PTC, is going to take over and run it, and they'll still have that same great crew of floor people, supervisors, and dealers. But just a tip of the final table hat, if you will, to Jimmy Sommerfeld, who I hope to see next month when I go down and play at the Palm Beach Kennel Club in a World Series of Poker circuit event there.
Well, I absolutely agree with you totally on that. A couple of key things you said there, and keep it moving along. See, part of the problem is when you get a little discrepancy, a question on the ruling or something like that, it can really bog down the table, and that upsets the rest of the people at the table, maybe. They were always there, they were always quick to respond, and they were always very precise in their ruling and stuck to it, and consistency. See, that's another thing that poker players love is the consistency on it. What I'm waiting for is for Jimmy to sit down and write a book about these 18 years and some of the stories he could tell, I think, would be phenomenal reading.
Yep.
That's what I want Jimmy to do.
I agree. So he's going to do Choctaw and Tunica and then Palm Beach, and that'll be it. March 1st is his official retirement date, so he won't be at the series this summer. And the poker community loves you and will miss you having you around, Jimmy. One other thing about Palm Beach. Their first event down there is going to be a $555 event, and this is on President's Weekend, the weekend of President's Day in February. Their first one will be a $555 buy-in. They're making it $1 million guarantee. Now, here's what's impressive about that. In order to do that, they've got to get 2,000 players at a tournament that last year got only 877. Not only, that was a huge number. First time they had a circuit event in Florida and have 877. That's a big turnout for a 555 event down there. Now they want to get 2,000, and to get there, they're adding more tables to the Palm Beach Kennel Club, and they're going to run three first days, 1A, 1B, 1C, and it's going to be a rebuy event. So yep. With that $1 million guarantee, I'm not so sure there's going to be an overlay, but if there is, that's going to be a heck of a tournament to be in.
It absolutely is. You're right about the rebuys. They don't add a huge amount, but you can have 8, 10, maybe 12% increase from rebuys from people. So it's not going to that alone would not increase it from the 800 and some they had last year. But I'm telling you, if you put the guarantee out there, they will come. It's almost like your Field of Dreams. You know, put the money out there, they will come.
Yeah.
And I honestly don't think there'll be an overlay by the time they get done with it.
I think you're probably right. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Dennis Phillips is at the PCA in the Bahamas enjoying the sunshine and the poker down there. I'm Paul Harris here in a slightly chillier St. Louis. Our show, of course, is brought to you by the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. You want to know what's going on in the room right now? Download an app for your iPhone and for your Android phone. It's called Bravo Poker Live, and you can actually click on the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room and see the games that they're spreading right now, and then there's a button to click that calls the room, and you can find out exactly what's going on. So that's available to you right now from the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis, and we'll be right back to talk more poker and more poker regulation and licensing possibilities with Chris Krafcik here on 590 of the Fan, KFNS and KFNS.com, and our podcast available on thechipleader.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Every Tuesday afternoon, we're live on 590 of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com from 3 to 4. And we're also available via podcast on demand anytime. You can subscribe via iTunes, or now you can subscribe via Stitcher, which is another terrific piece of podcast software that you can download for either your iPhone or your Android phone. We had a lot of listeners who have been tweeting to us, hey, how come you're not on Stitcher? How come I can't get you on my Android phone? Well, now you can. You can go to our website, thechipleader.com, and click on the Final Table Radio Show page. And right there, there's a Stitcher logo that'll take you to our podcast page, and there's a button where you can download the audio. Or if you have your phone with you right now, download Stitcher there, and then search for Final Table Poker Show. And you can subscribe and keep up with our podcasts each and every week. We've got 153 shows in the can when we're done with today. And you can always search all of those on our website, thechipleader.com. I'm Paul Harris here in St. Louis. We're sponsored, of course, by the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. My partner, Dennis Phillips, is not in St. Louis and not in Las Vegas. He's in the Bahamas enjoying some sunshine and some poker at the PCA, the PokerStars Caribbean Adventure, for, I think, the fourth year in a row. And we're joined now by Chris Krafcik, who has helped us out a couple of times with talking about the various legislation regarding online poker's possible return to the U.S. Chris is the Research Director, North America, for Gambling Compliance. That's a leading regulatory news and research provider for global gambling industry. Hi, how are you, Chris?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me back. Good to be here.
Nice to have you back. Let's start with the famous DOJ letter, which we talked about on our year-end show, because that was a real interesting thing to come out from the Department of Justice right around Christmas time, essentially saying what many people in the online poker world think is, you know what, all of this stuff about online poker not being legal in the U.S. because of the Wire Act of 1961, may no longer be true. What's your take on it?
I think it's a really interesting piece of information that came out from the Justice Department. For nearly a decade and a half, the DOJ had held essentially that what are called transmissions of communications relating to wagering on a sporting event or contest. And so essentially all that means is kind of information that has to do with sporting events or contests. So if you were to click, like go on an online gaming website and you were to lay a sports bet, right, and you clicked bet on the website, well, that information is going to travel near and far, maybe across state lines. And so what the DOJ has said for a long time is that such information, if it travels across state lines, is considered illegal under the Wire Act, right? And so what's changed now is that for a long time, the DOJ has held that not only does the Wire Act apply to data transmissions regarding wagering on a sporting event or contest, but also that the Wire Act applies to transmissions not relating to a sporting event or contest that are still related to wagering. I know that's a little confusing, but essentially what's happened now is that the DOJ has suddenly reversed course and said, no, the Wire Act applies only to data transmissions concerning wagering on a sporting event or contest. And so I think what's happened in the media is that has been read by some is that now, by some miracle, internet poker is finally legal, and that the way has been cleared for internet poker to be legalized and all sorts of other bullish projections. And really, near term, the opinion has not legalized or otherwise authorized internet gambling at any level of U.S. government. Rather, the opinion has only removed a compliance conflict, I think, between states that want to offer non-sports gambling over the internet and the Wire Act. Right, and so all that means now is that the DOJ cannot come into a state and say, listen, if you want to offer, say, internet poker within the bounds of your state, we're actually not going to bother you based on our prior interpretation of the Wire Act. Go ahead and do it. But interestingly, the opinion has not resolved conflicts between the Wire Act and other federal laws pertaining to internet gambling, which I won't even go into here. And the opinion is not binding, which means that it could be revised by a subsequent administration. So let's say Romney gets elected in 2012. And whoever his Justice Department appointees are could say, well, let's revisit this Wire Act opinion that was issued by the Justice Department last year. And if we believe differently, meaning if we believe that the Wire Act indeed does apply to all sorts of data transmissions that concern wagering, then we can go ahead and rework this opinion to coincide with the old opinion. I know that this is a little confusing, but there's just so much to this that's not being covered well, I think, in the mainstream media. And I think it's a little too early to tell right now whether this is going to be some significant boon to the U.S. internet gambling industry. It's certainly being read that way. My question is it really? So.
Well, as a follow-up to that, my curiosity is this. I know that Nevada and a number of other states are putting regulations on the books. They're trying to get ready to be able to offer online poker. Does this open it up for both intra and interstate? Can they do compromises like they do with the lottery?
That's a good question. I'm actually not sure how to answer that. The lawyers that I've spoken with seem to believe that there is potential now, given the Justice Department's new reading of the Wire Act, that states could enter into compacts with each other for purposes of offering internet poker across their borders. So a simpler way of saying that is, like, sure, if Nevada and, let's say, the state where I live and where Paul is, Missouri, you know, if Nevada and Missouri wanted to enter into some sort of compact, could they do that? And some lawyers are arguing that, yes, indeed, given the Justice Department's new reading of the Wire Act, states could enter into multi-state compacts for purposes of offering internet poker, just as they do for multi-state lottery games. So, yes, I've been hearing that as well.
Chris, when we talked to you several months ago, you were pessimistic that anything was going to happen on the front, particularly at the federal level, in 2012. And I was pessimistic about that as well. Some of the online players who have been sitting out since April 15th and wondering when they can get their jobs back, effectively. Every time I see one of them, they always ask me, what do you know? When's it going to happen? And I keep telling them, you know what? 2014 still seems to me to be a pretty good guess. But could we be talking this year, at least on the intrastate level, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I think so. On the state level, there are some very interesting things happening right now. Not relating to poker is really where most of the activity is going to be, and I know that that's not really of great interest to poker players, but in some way it does concern them because it's kind of just the itty-bitty stepping stones of internet gambling expansion, if you want to put it that way. So what's happening in several states at the moment is that lotteries actually are exploring internet gaming opportunities, and by internet gaming opportunities I mean just direct sale of individual lotto tickets over the internet. And, you know, it doesn't seem like, you know, the Neil Armstrong One Giant Leap for Mankind kind of development for internet gambling, but in the U.S. it is, because, you know, formally there really have been no forms of legal regulated internet gambling other than betting on horse races, a little bit of stuff on fantasy sports, and some sweepstakes-based internet gaming. So this is pretty significant. So you're going to have the Illinois Lottery and the New York Lottery. Those two are going to begin selling virtual lottery tickets over the internet. That will probably start in the first quarter of 2012. And you also have a number of other lotteries in Massachusetts, in Maryland, in New Hampshire, probably at least three or four or five even different lotteries looking at sort of different ways to expand in internet gaming. And then you have kind of the outlier among the lotteries, which is the D.C. lottery. And that's the lottery for the Federal District of Columbia. And that lottery, interestingly, is actually looking at offering internet poker, blackjack, and bingo, if I remember correctly. So we're going to have maybe at least one lottery offering internet poker within the District of Columbia, which should be interesting. And then as we kind of broaden out beyond lottery-related stuff to, you know, more mainstream forms of commercial gaming like poker and casino games and whatnot, I believe that New Jersey will probably be the first and perhaps the only state to pass enabling internet gambling legislation this year. And what New Jersey is essentially looking at is internet poker and any other casino table game that's offered inside an Atlantic City casino. I know there are a number of games. I don't remember them all off the top of my head at the moment. And then also we have Nevada, which is really interesting because at the end of December, I believe, the Nevada Gaming Commission signed off on the final draft of internet gambling enabling regulations. And so the hope is that sometime in 2012, companies will be able to apply and be given licenses to either operate internet poker games within the state of Nevada, supply software to internet poker operators in the state of Nevada, or supply ancillary services to the software providers in Nevada. So what we might see by the end of the year in 2012 at the state level is that maybe operators will just begin to operate internet poker in Nevada, and that if legislation passes in New Jersey in January or February, which is the hope of the lead sponsor of that legislation there, maybe we could have regulations drafted within 90 days of that bill passing in New Jersey, so that would kind of kick things out to like March or April, May even, and maybe they would be doing licensing application of some kind by the end of the year in New Jersey. I doubt seriously that they would be online and taking bets and doing whatnot there. So Nevada for sure probably having some commercial activity, New Jersey maybe getting to the licensing process, but anything beyond that I think is a real stretch. And if you guys have other questions about what's going on in other states, I'll shut up for now and let you ask them to me.
Well, I've got kind of a dumb question, but just out of curiosity. Worldwide, there's now, I think, 500-plus online sites. If this becomes common in the U.S. or available in the U.S., can you see some sort of restrictions put on it by the states, either monetarily or brick-and-mortar-wise, or number of licenses? How are they going to keep the market from being flooded just by anybody who wants to start up a site?
Well, it's interesting because it kind of invokes some different theories of economics, meaning like, you know, if we're just talking about an individual state, and let's just, again, use Missouri as an example. If Missouri was mulling whether to introduce internet poker legislation, one of the things that the lawmakers would be debating is essentially, you know, do we, you know, for reasons of public interest and, you know, social well-being, do we limit the number of sites available in Missouri? So in the legislation, do we write in some provision that says, okay, Missouri will only allow 5 internet poker sites, and that there will be some sort of competitive bidding process for those licenses? Or do we simply say, okay, well, there might be some legal problems if we try to introduce artificial restrictions like that in the license application process? Do we just say, okay, any number, so an unlimited number of entities can apply for a license, and do we just let the market sort of sort out the winners from the losers? Because, as we know, poker is an industry that is fairly dependent on having a sustainable player base. And if that player base is divided up, in essence, between too many parties, then nobody's going to do well. And so what happens in markets like that eventually is that the industry consolidates. And so no matter what, even if a state limits the number of Internet poker operators, there's going to be, I think there's going to be some problems perhaps from a legal perspective, but also it's just kind of, you know, is there a good enough reason to say no to a certain number of operators, or do we just allow, you know, any number of operators to apply and let the market sort itself out? I think that's one of the big debates actually that's happening right now in California and other markets. And I think what we're seeing in Nevada, for instance, is there's no limit on the number of licenses that are going to be offered. So I think what we're seeing happen, in essence and in some, is that states are just kind of handling this differently based partly on political considerations, what they think constituents have appetite for in terms of Internet gaming generally and the number of Internet gambling operators they might want to introduce specifically. So I think we'll see different states taking different views on that issue.
Talking with Chris Krafcik from Gambling Compliance here on the Final Table Poker Show with Dennis Phillips in the Bahamas. I'm Paul Harris here in St. Louis. With all this talk about Nevada, which is likely to be the first one out of the gate with intrastate online poker, you got a couple of big operators there who have come out against it, guys who run some of the big resorts in the Las Vegas area who have come out. They have ostensibly said that they don't think that you'd be able to keep underage gamblers from accessing their sites, which is odd to me because we seem to be able to do okay with that if you have regulation compared to when you don't have regulation, which we didn't before April 15th. And there are all sorts of arguments that could be made one way or the other when it comes to age verification. But here's my question for you, Chris. Is this really coming from guys who are just not technologically going to be ready to compete with the big boys, and so they want to make sure that it doesn't become legal because somebody else would then have an edge on them to make a lot of money?
Well, I think that's definitely an interesting point. I think some of the Nevada companies are making preparations to go online, and you know, some of them control assets that would give them some kind of advantage. Like Harris, for instance, has the World Series of Poker brand, which puts them in a nice position to move online, whereas maybe a smaller locals joint in Reno might not have something as enticing as that. But I think, tough question, I think there's definitely some truth to it, but I think also there are some operators out there that have not had experience, meaning like they've not maybe gone to a foreign jurisdiction and kind of been asked to see the behind-the-scenes view, for instance, of an up-and-running Internet gambling operator and how all the technology actually works, and more importantly, how effectively that technology works. So I think part of it is just an education gap between some of the operators that are really interested in doing Internet and have put in the time and effort to merely make sure that they're boned up on all they need to be boned up on. But then there's kind of the smaller operators which are seeing this maybe more as a limited economic opportunity, that are seeing maybe the introduction of Internet gambling as a threat to their land-based facilities on a revenue or economic performance level. So I think that the argument is really complicated. There's a lot of different facets in there that maybe some of the Nevada entities just aren't quite as sold on as some of the properties, maybe like on the Las Vegas Strip, like Wynn or MGM or Caesars, that have really been putting quite a bit of time into getting up to speed on what's happening with Internet gambling.
Well, again, I think we're seeing kind of a flip-flop there, because Caesars and MGM were against this. Now they are preparing their own sites, and they've partnered up with someone, and now they seem to be for it. I think I agree with you. It's just a little bit of a lack of education is maybe what's going on.
Yeah, it's. I guess we'll see what happens. I think that regardless, like in Nevada, for instance, even though there is a lack of education, and even though there's probably a lack of consensus among all the hundreds of entities that run gaming facilities in Nevada. It's just the Gaming Commission and the Gaming Control Board there seem to think that, you know, it's not a problem, and regulations have been passed, and it appears that, you know, maybe later this year, as soon as later this year, there will be some sort of commercial activity there in terms of internet poker. So it looks, even though there might be concerns about age verification and geolocation, it seems that the regulators there are comfortable enough with the technology to say yes to it. And as we all know here, the Nevada is, you know, the gold standard in terms of gaming regulation in the United States. So I think a lot of other states are actually kind of waiting to see what happens there with some of this. You know, is the technology actually going to be effective? Will there be problems in terms of consumer protection, age verification, identity verification, location verification? Will there be any problems with that? Will that create any kind of blowback for Nevada politicians that were involved in passing the legislation and the regulators that were involved in drafting the regulations? So I don't know. I think it should be an interesting kind of experiment to see this year whether Nevada gets anything going and whether everything kind of runs seamlessly or there are some problems.
So we know that Nevada is likely to be one of the leaders. What about our home states of Missouri and Illinois? They're going to be laggards, aren't they?
Well, I wouldn't say Illinois. As I was mentioning earlier, in terms of what lotteries are doing, Illinois is sort of at the leading edge of what lotteries are doing right now in the United States on internet gaming. And in the first quarter of 2012, I believe, the lottery there is going to begin selling individual draw tickets over the internet. And again, as I was saying earlier, that's a pretty big step for state lotteries. So even though that might sound very interesting or sexy to us, I mean, like, it's a pretty big deal.
Where's the age verification software? I'm kidding.
So Illinois, yeah, they're kind of going to be at the leading edge, at least in terms of what the lotteries are doing, in terms of internet gaming, in terms of whether we'll see poker or casino games. No, definitely not next year. And then Missouri, the lottery here also is very interesting because they're kind of exploring what's called a private management contract. And all that means is that Missouri is mulling whether to have a outside third-party commercial company come in and run certain parts of the lottery here in hopes of maximizing economic performance. And what we've seen historically with private management contracts is that when you bring a kind of third-party commercial operator in, that operator is going to try in whatever way it can to maximize performance. And one of the ways to maximize performance is to look very hard at how to utilize internet gaming channels, right? So if we had a third-party private manager here running our lottery, I would definitely think that there's going to be at least internal discussion about how to use the internet, how to use mobile phones for delivery of internet lottery products. And so even though Missouri is probably not going to be involved in the first wave of states that regulate internet poker or casino gaming, the lottery here is definitely looking at more advanced solutions for delivery of lottery products. So I wouldn't be surprised to see Missouri doing something more interesting on the lottery end in the next couple of years.
Excellent. Can I switch subjects just a little bit? I've got another question, something that's come out basically as a result of Black Friday of April 15th of last year and the problems with the players' deposits. Stars has implemented a new concept that they're hoping will become the standard for the industry. In France, they are turning over all deposits to a third party to be monitored, controlled, and everything to ensure that they are safely kept for all of the players. Do you think that's a positive thing? Do you think that's something that should be implemented in the U.S.?
I'm not sure, actually. I think that, you know, my immediate thought is that it's a really great way for PokerStars to attempt to restore consumer confidence levels. Now, as we know, after Black Friday, they were able to seamlessly repay customers, and that wasn't a huge deal for them as it was for Full Tilt, and as we know, that's still going on for Full Tilt. But I think it's an interesting from a PR perspective that PokerStars would attempt to do something like that. And I mean, even if it is only for from a PR point of view, meaning if they are only simply trying to do this to better their own image, I think in some way that it does have a secondary effect, which is, you know, it increases transparency and it allows consumers maybe to feel more confident about where and how their money is being held, and especially knowing that their money would be kept segregated from whatever operating accounts poker stars would be using for day-to-day stuff. So I think it feels net positive to me, but I think that it would be interesting to actually ask a regulator in Nevada or someplace, you know, what they would think in terms of, like, you know, is that industry standard? Is that something that's typically done? Is it something new and interesting that regulators around the world should actually consider implementing? I don't have that kind of knowledge base to really answer it, but definitely an interesting thing that they're doing, no doubt.
Chris, since you mentioned Full Tilt, I've got to ask about the recent developments towards the end of the year with Group Bernard Tapie and the DOJ and the deals with the shareholders and all that sort of stuff. And by the way, I love the story that came out last week about Phil Ivey's income from Full Tilt, which came out in divorce papers from his now ex-wife, who apparently wants more money. It came out that Full Tilt was paying him $11 million a year, $920,000 a month. Which I want to ask Dennis about in just a second here. But what do you know about any developments in the last few weeks about Full Tilt and their deal with the Group Bernard Tapie and the Department of Justice, and most importantly, Full Tilt players getting their money back?
Nothing further at this time, and I guess I have to admit it's not something that I've been looking at closely the last few weeks. I don't think I'd be the best person to ask about most recent developments. That I heard, or my most updated knowledge on Full Tilt would probably stop somewhere in early to mid-December.
Yeah.
So I don't think I'm the best guy to ask about that.
Okay, I don't think we've heard anything out of the Department of Justice, have we, Dennis?
No, nothing further in the last few weeks, really. Not for sure what's going to happen. There's been a noticeable lack of any kind of comments, both from the DOJ and from the Bernard Tapie group anymore. And the last few comments we heard were from the attorneys with his group, and they haven't been verified by the DOJ, so I'm not for sure what's going on there.
All right, but Dennis, for you, what about that $11 million that Phil Ivey was being paid? Is there any poker player who was getting paid anything like that? And nobody else was getting paid that kind of money, I don't think, but who was bringing that much return for his company? You know, if you had Tiger Woods in the days when he was one of the top endorsers in the world, he probably sold a lot of golf balls and golf clubs and Nike stuff. Michael Jordan certainly did the same. Well, Phil Ivey is the Tiger Woods or Michael Jordan of poker. Do you think he brought extra people to come to Full Tilt in the days when he represented them to the tune of $11 million a year?
I definitely think Phil Ivey is a draw. I definitely think he had huge media value. I definitely think he brought people to Full Tilt. $11 million a year, that's really stretching it. So I don't even know what in the past was a justifiable salary and a justifiable return for him. I do know that since Black Friday, since everything's been happening in here, that there's no player on the planet that's worth anywhere near that anymore in today's economy.
All right,
whether it was worth that in the past or not is questionable. He was definitely the highest paid and should have been the highest paid. But that was quite a salary or quite a return.
All right. To go back to something that Chris was talking about before, about the likelihood of Nevada not only being the leader, but perhaps getting intrastate online poker going this year. You know, we've talked about some of the pros in Las Vegas moving out of the country up to Canada. Phil Galfond went up there. Doc Sands and Erica Motina moved up there. A lot of the people in Panorama Towers have started up Panorama Towers North, as we suggested they might on this show. Daniel Negreanu has got a condo in Toronto where he goes up there and plays, which he can do because he's a Canadian citizen. If Nevada does legalize intrastate online poker, do you think there'll suddenly be an influx of pros to Nevada and to Las Vegas again?
Actually, there probably will be. Don't know to what tune or anything like that. And it depends on the successfulness and how many players to get actively playing there. People will try it out. Then they'll see if they like the site, if they like the way it's played, if they like the way it's controlled. And also, and this has not been addressed, maybe Chris can help me with this. I don't know what kind of taxation and what kind of rake they're going to require there in Nevada to play in the States. Is it going to be expensive? Is it going to be still cheaper for them to stay in Canada and play? Do you have any clue on that?
That I don't, actually. I know that I just can't remember the rate of taxation in Nevada off the top of my head and what that's going to be for internet poker. So rather than speculate, that's something that I can look at. But I remember that it's kind of complicated. But I seem to remember, why not speculate for a minute? I seem to remember the rate of taxation being 6.75% for an operator's gross gaming revenues, maybe. And what I don't know is I know for sure that it, at least in some provinces anyway, internet poker is not regulated in Canada. And what I don't know off the top of my head are, within the provinces that internet poker is regulated, what's the tax rate on it? So in terms of doing a comparison between the Nevada speculated rate and whatever it is in Canada, I can't pull it off the top of my head. Sorry.
All right. Chris, we appreciate your time today. One last thing I do want to ask you about, non-poker related. New Jersey has been talking about legalizing sports betting to try to get some revenue going there and to compete with Nevada, which pretty much owns the concept of going to March Madness and betting on all the games and, you know, the Super Bowl coming up and all of that sort of stuff. How close is Jersey to doing that?
Well, I'd say it's still pretty far yet. What we saw this week was that the legislature did pass a bill that would allow New Jersey residents to bet in horse racing facilities and in Atlantic City casinos on all professional and certain amateur sporting events. And what needs to happen now is that New Jersey will need to initiate a suit in federal court that challenges the constitutionality of the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, which is a federal law that essentially prohibits all but four states from operating sports betting. And so in order for New Jersey to be able to offer sports betting, federal law has to be either overturned in federal court, or Congress has to amend the Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act to allow states essentially to offer sports betting. And I know that, at least in terms of the court challenge, I'm not sure how long that will take. I know that Senator Lesniak and some of the other folks in New Jersey who are going to be involved with that suit intend to file immediately, as soon as Governor Christie signs the sports betting bill. In terms of what's happening at the federal level, I know that Representative Lobiondo from New Jersey intends to file, I think, two different bills that regard the Professional Amateur Sports Protection Act. I think one would overturn it, and then the other one would amend it to allow, I think, all states to essentially make their own decision as to whether they want to offer sports betting or not. So it's kind of a complicated process, but the court challenge, not sure on the timing of that piece, and then what would happen federally. I think anything generally that has to do with sports betting that's going on in Congress has very little chance of passing, so I wouldn't give that really any, or I should say much, hope of happening this year or ever.
So for the time being, for our listeners in New Jersey who are poker players who have a sports betting leak, you're still going to have to lose that money to your bookie, not to the local casinos.
Yep, that's right.
Chris Krafcik is Research Director, North America for Gambling Compliance, a leading regulatory news and research provider for the global gambling industry. It's always a pleasure, Chris. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, guys, thanks so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for being here on the Final Table. Dennis, we have to wrap things up, and I know you've got a tournament you've got to run off to there at the PCA. What's the schedule for the last few days? Because you're not quite done, are you?
No. There was over 40 tournaments down here besides the main event. They had a variety of them that were really quite interesting, some different combinations, you know, the Omaha 8, Stud 8, that type of a thing. They had a ante-only tournament, which was kind of cool. They had a win-the-button tournament coming up, which is kind of cool.
Hold on one second. What is an ante-only tournament? You mean there are no blinds?
Basically, the ante just keeps increasing, correct. The ante goes up instead of the blinds going up.
So,
and your antes can actually get up to 1,000, 2,000, whatever. Huge difference way to play the game then.
Yeah, because now everybody's got dead money involved in the hand.
That's it.
So they're trying new things down there, too.
They absolutely are. One of the interesting ones that's coming up in a couple of days is a huge bounty tournament. It's a $2,000 buy-in. $1,000 goes into the prize pool. $1,000 bounty on every player.
Wow.
Yeah. So some interesting games coming up down here in the last few days of the PTA.
And what are you planning on playing this afternoon?
Well, there's a $2,000 one that starts in a few minutes. That's what I'm looking at right now. There's a couple of other tournaments later on. We'll see what it brings. Not for sure what all I'm going to be playing down here.
All right. Well, good luck in whatever it is, and we'll get another report from you when you're done with the PCA and back home in Vegas next week.
Okay, sounds good.
All right, that's Dennis Phillips at the PokerStars Caribbean Adventure in the Bahamas. I am Paul Harris here in St. Louis. Our show, of course, brought to you by the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. Don't forget, the qualifiers for the main event of the World Series of Poker go on not this weekend, but next weekend. That'll be January 21st and 22nd. And the weekend after that, we've got the big game, the $15,000 2550 no-limit game going on here. We call it Big Game 2, and if you want to be a part of that, you can email us at DennisPhillipsPoker@gmail.com. You can also get us on Twitter. He's online as Dennis_Phillips. I'm online as Paul Harris Show. So use all the social media you can find. We're also both on Facebook. You can find us there at stay in touch with the show. And join us every Tuesday at 3 for the Final Table Poker Radio Show on 590 of the Fan KFNS and KFNS.com. Or download and subscribe to our podcast via iTunes and Stitcher or on thechipleader.com.